The following session was recorded in Seal, Alabama, October 2011, and is presented by Cynthia Nicholson. Compassion fatigue.
Compassion fatigue. My experience was not compassion fatigue. Mine was burnout. We were in our second term on the field, and a pastor was visiting us. He and his sons were staying at our house, and the team was in a hotel, and we were working every day. And I was cooking for the whole team. Happy. I was happy. I was glad to have these Americans there. They brought sneakers for my son who needed new shoes and, you know, candy for American brands. Cool. And so this pastor was sitting in my kitchen at the table while I was peeling potatoes for the next meal. And he said, "Cynthia, what's wrong?" You know, with this nice, tender, caring sound. I said, "Oh, nothing." He said, "You're crying." I said, "I don't know what's going on. You know, it's just tears coming out of my eyes. I mean, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me." And he said, "Are you sure?" I said, "No, there's absolutely, everything's fine. It's just, I'm leaking. I don't know what that's about." He said, "I think you're on burnout." Well, how could I be on burnout? Didn't have time. I was a mom. I was directing a ministry. I was the ICI director. I had, you know, these obligations, and I'm cooking for 40 people. And about 6 months later, we were itinerating. We were home on furlough in his church. And he looked at my face, and he said, "Now you're fine." It does take time to recover. Let's not get there. So we'll talk about the differences between burnout, compassion fatigue, and all that. Today, I would like to begin with a little self-test. Would everybody take out a piece of paper and just write 1 through 9, and you're either going to write yes or no, okay? These are the statements, and it will determine whether you're at risk for compassion fatigue, okay? Number one, personal concerns commonly intrude on my professional role. You're going through doing your job, but you're worried about, oh my goodness, back at the house, or I need to be doing this, or I've got a doctor appointment coming up. Your personal issues keep you from paying attention when you're in your professional role. Just intrudes. Let's think of them as intrusive thoughts. Number two, yes or no? Number two, my colleagues seem to lack understanding. You're surrounded by people who are just kind of, duh, what? Okay? Your colleagues lack understanding. If you're... Well, if it seems that way to you, you got to write it down. Number three, I find even small changes enormously draining. Please don't give me another change of policy. Please don't change this. Please don't change that. I want it. I like it the way it is. I like regular. I don't want upsets. If that's you, if you're drained by changes. Number four, I can't seem to recover quickly after association with trauma. When you see trauma, it affects you deeply, personally, and you can't get past it quickly. You carry it. Maybe you'll wake up in the night. Maybe you can't go to sleep. Okay? Next, association with trauma affects me very deeply. Wow, I can go there with them. I can really identify in their pain. I'm very much affected by the trauma I see, the trauma that's around me. The next, my parishioners' stress, or the people that are under my ministry. Their stress affects me deeply. If they're stressed, you feel their stress, you become, it's kind of like contagious, you feel it. Next, I have lost my sense of hopefulness. We will never make it to the end of the month with the bills paid. There's no way out. I'll never get to do this or that. Hopeless. I feel vulnerable all the time. Yes or no? Vulnerable. Do I feel like somebody's out to get me or somebody's going to take advantage of me? I have to be careful that I protect myself at all times because I'm at risk. I'm vulnerable. And finally, I feel overwhelmed by unfinished personal business. That can be my grown kid who's not walking with the Lord. That's unfinished personal business, but I'm overwhelmed by it. Okay? Now, count up your yeses. If you have answered yes to four or more, you may actually be suffering from compassion fatigue right now. Now, obviously, this is a self-test. There are qualifiers. How severely do you mean yes? It's just a guideline. But it's to give you an awareness of what some of the thinking patterns are for a person who is in compassion fatigue. It's a quick check for your state of mind. I presented this to at a compassion forum a number of years ago for missionaries. And following the session, a missionary in a difficult country, very difficult country, came to me with his piece of paper. I had this as a handout. He brought me his piece of paper. He said, "Does 9 for 9 mean I'm in trouble?" I said, "Yeah." I recommended he get help. And the person I told him that I thought would be helpful for him, because I knew, where he was from, and I thought that person would be helpful. He said, I went to him, and he told me to pull up my boots and act like a man. I said, okay, that wouldn't have been a counseling approach. So sorry, I affirmed that person, and I made sure I never recommended that person again to anybody else. But there are a whole lot of other things than saying to somebody, pull yourself up, act like a man, when you're overwhelmed and jeopardized in your emotional state because of the trauma you are experiencing around you. Let's describe now what compassion fatigue is all about. First of all, our default wiring is to help. This picture is from our daughter and son-in-law that are church planters out in California. They've got this new little church. It's been going like a year and a half. And they combined with their old little church. They pastor both at the same time, about 15, 20 minutes apart. And so they can do one service early, run to the other one for the second service later. And this is their group that they made an announcement. They said, they're in Southern California out in the desert, and they said, we're going to make a little trip down to a children's home across the border in Mexico. And anybody that wants to come, come. Well, that's the group. People want to help. It's a natural response to need. Well, not everybody could come. So they said, okay, that week we went to Mexico. Next week we're going to go to Indio. Yeah, it's called Mecca. Mecca is a city in Southern California that has a lot of Mexicans who have left Mexico, and they're in worse shape than had they been in Mexico, because here there's no running water, no electricity. I mean, they're living in really tough circumstances. So the people from the church go to help. They brought toys. They brought clothes. They brought Pampers. They brought gallons of water. They brought stuff. Just because that's a human response, it's a good thing. Okay. with that as foundational of what our expectations are. Scientifically, we've discovered a whole lot. I love brain studies. I'm really into the brain. They've discovered that there is a neural wiring. When I'm in a situation where I am going to help another person and I have connection with that person, they're called mirror neurons. And I can actually reflect what they're feeling. I can feel what they're feeling if I've experienced that at some time. Let me look in your eyes. Oh, I'm not allowed out of my box here. Come to me. Okay, come in a little closer. Your name is?
Karen.
Where are you from?
From Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Oklahoma. I'm going to do a fictitious thing because I don't want to bring in your real life. But let's say there's been a tragedy in your hometown. And you went, say, Joplin. Oklahoma is close enough to Joplin that you went to help the victims of the disaster out in Joplin. You come and you tell me about it. As you're talking to me, I'm tracking with you. The eye-to-eye contact. You're telling me painful stories of people. You're telling me horrible things. My eyes can very easily well up with tears listening to her. Why? Because I have experienced what she is communicating. When her face looks a certain way, my mirror neurons interpret that. Think about when you're watching a video of a roller coaster and you're on the down, your stomach goes whoop, right? Why? Maybe when you fell out of the crib, you felt that whoop, what it feels like to be falling toward the earth. Your brain, the body, remembers emotional sensations. It's programmed into you. The body remembers. So her body remembered what her feelings are. I'm mirror neuroning her feelings, and I get to feel it. I'm feeling what she's feeling. We are actually touched with the feelings of others' infirmities. We're touched. It actually is real. It's not just pie in the sky, Jesus wrote it, and it doesn't mean anything. It's real. When you smell a smell from 20 years ago, you know, your aunt's kitchen that had a certain odor to it, and you smell that fragrance, it comes back into your mind because your body remembers. The memory in your body is engraved. Thank you. Okay, so when we're dealing with the caring individual, we are all caring individuals. We would not be in caring ministries if we weren't caring individuals. We are wired to help. So we want to. We want to track with people. We want to be in that touch and be touched. But it will affect us. Okay. Ministers as caregivers, hurting people surround us. I went with this missionary up to this LACC school up in the mountains of Costa Rica, this little girl, make sure that her little sister gets to school every day. She walks every day to make sure her sister gets to the school so that they get an education. She has a severe heart problem. She needs heart surgery. And when she goes home from surgery, she's going to lie on a pallet on the floor. She doesn't even have a mattress. So the missionary hears this story. The teacher tells her the story. And she goes, we got to do something about this. She raises money. The child now has a bed. She came home from the surgery. She's okay. When we can affect change for somebody, wow, we feel wonderful. It kind of restores, it replenishes, but we don't always get to replenish. A lot of times, we just keep helping, 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 and we don't see the fruit of our helping in a way that brings us back a, that feels good, this little girl's going to make it. Let's look at the definition. Compassion fatigue is a state of exhaustion and dysfunction, biologically, psychologically, socially, and spiritually, as a result of working with victims of traumatic events. Prolonged exposure to someone else's struggle results in PTSD-like symptoms in the caregiver. That's what compassion fatigue is. It is secondary PTSD. I started studying PTSD as my disorder of choice when I was working on my master's at AGTS. It was during the years that the year that Hurricane Mitch hit in Central America and Hurricane George hit in the Dominican Republic. And I said, whoa, this is serious stuff. Our missionaries are dealing with stuff they were never trained for. Hurricane Mitch, I don't know if you remember that long ago, but water, the hurricane hovered for days, filled a volcano with water, and it burst open, not because it blew, but because the mountain collapsed from the pressure of the water inside, burying all the villages in its path. My husband stood on ground knowing that there was a village underneath this ground now of people that were gone. We talked to people who, in the surge of water, their baby was swept out of their arms. They saw the wife or the husband swept away in the river, and they feel the guilt of survival. Why am I left? Where do I begin? A guy in Dominican Republic stood on the ground. He said, my family is under my feet somewhere. They're in this mud. They're down there somewhere. And you go in and you go, I'm going to be a Bible teacher. I'm gifted. I can do this. And then all of a sudden, they're saying to you, okay, this week you're going to take food to that community. You're going to have to cross through jungle and dangerous terrain. And you're going, I'm not qualified for that. Big deal. Qualifications have nothing to do with it. We're in a state of emergency. This is what we do. We step up. The Bible school in Honduras, La Ceiba, no, it was in San Pedro Sula, Bible school, 200 people capacity. 2,000 people were staying in the Bible school. It became a refugee camp. And so when they're all done and everybody starts moving back to tent housing and whatever they could get, the Bible school was destroyed. I mean, forget it. It had to be rebuilt and refurbished because it was what it was, but it served the need of the moment. Those crucial needs of the moment. What is trauma? Trauma overwhelms the senses. It's not just that it's unexpected and something bad that happens. It totally goes beyond what you're capable of dealing with. And many times those of us who are in the caring professions are called upon to do things outside of the realm of what we've been trained to do. So this guy looks like how a lot of our missionaries felt about the time of Hurricane Mitch. A few years ago we had those of you who've been out in the tsunami area know about that. We had earthquakes in El Salvador a few years back. And our missionaries would say, okay, all day long we're going and helping the victims whose houses came down, but we come back to our house, and after the major two earthquakes, there were 1,000 aftershocks. So every aftershock, they would watch the crack in the walls of their houses grow, and they'd go, when is my house going to come down? And so here you're being the caregiver, you're helping somebody in need, but you're also in trouble. Okay, guys, you are dealing with people who have lived trauma. They've experienced severe trauma. If you have also in your life experienced trauma, you are vulnerable to have that stuff kicked back up at the time that you become the caregiver of these other people. You have to really guard your heart, protect your heart, because you will go into your default mode of, I'm going to do it, because that's what you're trained to do. But you can only go so far. And when you run out, you can hit the wall. And you can say, okay, I'm 9 for 9. Everybody around me is really ticking me off here. I'm not happy. I'm not satisfied. There is no pleasure in what I do. Let's keep going. The definition, the Red Cross estimates that there are 70,000 incidents that prompt an emergency response in the United States and Canada, in Puerto Rico, every year. 70,000. How many of them happen in the cities? Great proportion. Where are teen challenge centers? Cities. Traumas. You know it. You see it. So, this is an extraordinary event that overwhelms the human capacity to adapt, and it evokes a response of catastrophe. Okay, you've got reactions. You've got physical reactions. There will be people that will go into a numbed shock, can't get out of bed. I only want to sleep. I don't want to go face what I'm facing. You can have cognitive reactions, mental responses that say, I don't believe anybody. You know, they're all blowing it out of proportion. Or you have your own take on things, and you're just not listening well because you'll kind of jump ahead to what you see. The emotional reaction is the most scary to others because they'll see outbursts, they'll see depression, they'll see anxiety. And if somebody, you remember from this morning when we said people with negative thinking need the check from outside to tell them whether they're accurate or not? Well, this is the time, a specific time, when we need outsiders to help us recognize if we're in perhaps a state of emotional drain. And interpersonal reactions, blowing out of proportion, something that would have been normally handled quite easily. Then we've got, that's trauma. The risk factors have to do with how long you know the person. Now, when you're talking like a disaster trauma, in the Dominican Republic, the people were furious at their government. It was magnified because they found out that the government knew that was coming, and they didn't prepare the people. They didn't let them know. And so here the thing comes, and they could have gone to higher ground. They could have gone to a safer place. They could have gone to relatives on the other side of the island. They were wiped out. And the bad thing was, is the risk factor of somebody who should have known, who could have done something about it, left them alone. Okay, you can interpret how this is working into your situations, and you're going, we've got a lot of risk factors going on in our ministries where people are expecting other people to be there to hold us up. What do we do when they're not there? How do we handle the trauma that's coming at us at that time? Okay, let's. The PTSD factors. You've got, how many of you have dealt with people that have PTSD? I would imagine a lot of you, yeah. And so you know about the hyperarousal. They're always in that ready to be startled. Don't walk up on a guy with PTSD quickly and, you know, poke him from behind. You know, they'll turn around and slam you real fast without even thinking about it. That hyperarousal state. Also, the numbing. They'll kind of numb out. They don't want that hyperarousal. And rather than try to remember something, they'll just block and go into a numb state. Obviously, PTSD has flashbacks as part of it. I've worked with a number of people who can't sleep because the flashbacks are so vivid and they're so afraid of falling asleep that they'll wake up in the cold sweat and, you know, it'll be just horrible. So it affects the sleep factors. Well, the very same things that are associated with PTSD are also what happens with secondary traumatic stress. These phrases are all the same. Secondary traumatic stress, STS, or compassion fatigue, are basically the same thing. It's what you experience as a result of working with a person who is there. Okay, let's see the difference. Okay, STS, vicarious traumatization. Some people will put burnout in that category, and here's the difference. Burnout is the continuing process of exhaustion, overwork. It's just basically your candle has been burning too long, and so you're at the tail end of your resources. You can sense it coming on. But in the compassion fatigue, that is a very different element because you can be so totally unaware that you're being drained, and de repente, all of a sudden, you're boom. You're so out of it. It's like a trigger happened. Just like with PTSD, the trigger will inspire a certain behavior that can come on very quickly. And burnout, basically, to get over it, you just need to rest. You get out of the environment. You go on vacation and you replenish. So many times, if you've got compassion fatigue, you'll need help to process what it has been that has gotten you there. And compassion fatigue has an empathy factor. With compassion fatigue, the interesting thing is we do empathize. We care, don't we? Jesus talks about he was moved with compassion. That's that empathy. We all want to be empathetic. When I'm sitting with a client in the counseling room, and I go home and I pray for that person. And when I was new at counseling, I'd go home with 8 clients in my head. And I'd want to be empathetic toward all 8 of them. And I'd pray in the night and say, Lord, help me know what's the right thing to help them, you know, next time we meet. And finally, I had to say, okay, Lord, they're yours. I'm going home. And will you please take care of them until next time I see them? And in the meantime, we're not going to stay there because that empathy will just suck your life out of you. Going back to what I said in the beginning about how we can catch the other person's emotional state. It's one thing to walk in another person's shoes, to be empathetic, to understand where they're coming from, to understand their environment, and to in the moment you're with them, when you're with them, really seriously empathize. Track with them. That's good. But when you're done, you have to say, Lord, they're in your hands, and I need to come to a place of wholeness again because I am actually partially broken when I'm that tracking with them. In a way, I put myself into that vulnerable place to show them how to be strong. I am the model. I'm coming into the whole. I'm doing it again. I'm so sorry. Somebody told a story when I was new in the counseling program. One of my professors said there were 2 guys that were friends. One fell in a hole, and he was down in the pit, and he was hurt, and he was yelling. And he said, please, I'm in a hole. Somebody help me out. And a priest comes by, and he says, I see you're in a hole. here, I'll pray for you, and here are a few rosary beads, and I'll toss down a scripture. And then he walked away. And then the doctor came by, and he said, oh, you're in a hole, and you, ooh, looks like you're bleeding. I'll throw down some bandages, here's some ointment, and take 2 aspirin. See ya. And he walked away. So the friend comes by, and he says, I see you're in a hole. He goes, yeah. And the friend jumps into the hole. And he says, you idiot. Now we're both in the hole. And the friend says, no, I know what you don't know. There are stairs in here, and I know the way out. That's what we want to do in our relationship with other people. We enter the hole with them, but we know the way out. So as you are identifying empathically with them in their pain, you're also the person in position to do something about it. There are stairs that they couldn't see because they were in the darkness, but you've been there before. You know the way out. You can walk them up those stairs. So when you're feeling that empathy for another person, you have to remember that your empathy is not Jesus' empathy. He'll stay empathic constantly with them. You have limits, and your limits end when you leave their presence. This is one of the teachings I gave to those policemen, those 80 policemen in Nicaragua. I said, you know, everybody talks about cop face. I had statistics from all over the world, not just from America. And I said, I know policemen suffer PTSD. And they're tracking with me. And I said, a lot of you suffer the crime, the corruption, the bloodshed, the violence, the rejection of society for when you're trying to be the good guy and, you know, they're looking at you as the bad guy. And so they're tracking. Then I talked about the risk factors. I said, if you've experienced war, trauma, whatever, violence yourself, you're more at risk for suffering the effects of it. Not all policemen get PTSD, but, you know, if you've got these risk factors, it really ramps up your possibility. Well, at lunchtime, the guy who is in charge of the event, the head commissioner for the whole police force of the nation, was the host, and he invited me to sit at his table. He said, do you know who we are? And I said, what do you mean by that? Of course I do. You're the head policeman for the country. He said, no, no. We won the war. I was with the Sandinistas that won the war. And these are the guys that had to become the police-keeping force because they drove out the former government and everybody that was in power in the former government. So they said, we're not here. You said, you know, policemen do this because we want to serve the community. No, we won the war. We had no choice. We had to do this job. And we've all been through the war. We are all in that category that you were talking about of really vulnerable to PTSD because of our war experiences, our war years when we were kids, when we were young. And go, okay, that puts a new perspective on where we go from here. Yeah. So that empathy factor is something that you really want to watch. Say, Lord, I don't want to close my heart. You don't want to put away empathy. Don't close your heart. That's not the solution. As I said to the policeman, cop face is a good thing when you're on the job because you're the people that they can trust to not go crazy when an accident has occurred. Everybody else is, and you're solid. You're dependable. So that's a good thing. But that's a bad thing on the way home. Put that person aside. Pull out the empathetic guy who's going to go home and play with your kids and open your heart and be kind and thoughtful and personable. Put the cop face away. Well, okay, this capacity that God has given us the capacity to be more than one thing at any one time. He's given us the capacity to fulfill the strength of Christ. He's given us the capacity to fulfill the tenderness of Christ. He's given us the capacity to feel, be touched with the feelings of infirmities, and at the same time say, Okay, my victorious risen king is capable of letting me put this in his hands while I go home and take care of myself. Do not feel guilty, ladies, when you go for a massage, no matter what your husband says about it's too much money. It's healthy for you to just do a little self-care sometimes. Not everybody has the same self-care methodology, but that's mine. But, you know, when you find that you replenish, guys, if going to watch the World Series is just like, whoa, this is good. Unless you're not for the Cardinals, you're not allowed to. But I knew that would happen. But whatever puts you back in a place of, okay, life is good and I'm normal. Things are doable within the context of what's called upon me. I can't always stay in a place where I'm giving, because then you will experience that burnout. Okay. Ministers' distinctives. There are characteristics of caregivers, whether they're medical, mental health, social workers, clergy. We all have in common a calling. We all feel like we're supposed to do what we're doing. We've got a certain amount of preparation. Here you are in this room. You're being prepared. We're doing ongoing continuing education units. Sometimes we're in a foreign context. By the way, I spoke about this at a Bible school in Argentina, and I said, you guys that are going out to church plant, let me tell you, even though you're going to be church planting in Argentina, you're going to a foreign context. If you've been raised in the city and you're going to church plant in the country, it's a foreign context. If you were raised in the country and you're here in Buenos Aires at Bible school, you're in a foreign context. You have to learn all over again what it means to operate outside of the realm of the known. So there's field experience, uniqueness of life in ministry. A lot of times you'll have family that doesn't know quite how to adjust to the expectations. You've got a schedule. You've got time off. What do you do with it? Are you allowed to really enjoy it? By the way, singles are the most pressed upon people in the world because people expect them to take their time off to do stuff that continues their work. Am I right? Does that ever happen? Any singles in here can attest to that? I've heard it so many times from singles saying, we're not allowed to have a life. I mean, like, when are we supposed to replenish? Okay. Absolutely.
As directors, we need to be very careful not to do this to our single staff that work under us. I'm conscious of it, and I have to stay on top of being conscious of it, not to treat them differently than I do my married staff. It's not fair to treat them as if they don't matter. You're going to burn your single staff out real quick if you're not conscientious of this at all times when you're doing scheduling and job duties and calling them on their time off when you wouldn't call a married staff on their time off, that kind of thing. So.
Thank you.
And when you're arousing, amen!
Amen!
And I'll give you one more word of advice to married women. When a single talks to you personally, she's only talking to you. She's not talking to your husband. So don't tell him what she said. Can't tell you how many times a married woman is so used to telling her husband everything that passes through her mind, so she just automatically shares. And when she automatically shares, it's doing a disservice. It's breaking confidence. And she will not be seen as trustworthy by the single anymore. So keep that really clear. You go, well, I can't keep secrets from my spouse. Put that one to rest. This is not a secret you're keeping from your spouse. It's a confidence you're honoring with another person. Okay? Yeah.
Is that strictly just with single people or with it?
Okay, I'm going to answer you. I'd say that's with anybody. Yeah. But it specifically applied to where we were, so I got to say another teaching that's not in my notes. I love that. Okay. So we've got these vulnerable personalities. Nurses are the ones who say, we are honored for going beyond ourselves. And how many times have we heard, I can give just a little bit more. Just a little, I can give a little bit more. That's a vulnerable personality. Okay, but it becomes a downward spiral. It starts with, tired me, poor me, to shame on me, to hate me, to hate others, to hate God for doing this to me. This is not exaggerated, friends. This is the downward spiral. This is where people end up. Where you go, how did they get there? How did they walk away from their faith? They had such a close relationship with the Lord. They were amazing servants of God. They were on track to be the next director of this ministry. And now they're, well, a lot of times, it was just stuff that was unchecked in the downward spiral. Okay. Continuing. Recognition, prevention, and treatment. We'll start with recognition. The first strategy is to be aware of the problem as well as its cause. Cognitive clarity. What does that mean? It means to be able to distinguish between what one can change and what one cannot change. Have we all prayed the prayer, Reinhold Niebuhr, Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I love that prayer. I could pray it every day. Every day. Because that's a mentality, a cognitive stand that gives me the capacity to say, hey, there are some things I just can't do. I have limitations. Okay, look at these cognitive shifts. A person is in jeopardy if they go from being a person who's got their dependence and trust in the Lord, they can take care of themselves, they're in good shape, to being suspicious of everybody. If they go from being a person who feels safe to being a person who has a heightened sense of vulnerability, they go from being a person that, yeah, I can do this, powerful sense of helplessness. And then they go from being independent to having their loss of personal control and freedom. Again, others' evaluation and intervention may be exactly what is necessary. Sometimes we can help in this intervention process by checking out what their previous coping strategies were. It really helps a lot. You know, if you see somebody that's in, you might suspect a PTSD-like state, they're having compassion fatigue, they might be in burnout. But if you're doing an intervention looking at, you saw these cognitive shifts in them, they're not on this side anymore, they're over here, then say, hey, have you ever been in a situation like this where you felt this way before? How did you get out of it? And as they describe for you what they did, one of the things that I love to do is ask people to tell me their testimony. And as they're telling their testimony, they're actually giving me clues as to how I can help them. Because I'll notice in their testimony what the things the Lord had done for them, the reinforcing. And their story, their testimony, is going to give you help to say, well, remember when the Lord did such and such for you? You know, he's still that same capable Lord. He could apply that in this area now. Okay. We'll go on. Okay, that was the recognition. Then we come to prevention. That's me, by the way. I'm in Haiti. I had just been all over the island, 14-hour drive for 97 miles. It took 14 hours to get there. So I'm at the home of the lady, and she said, I'm going to call my friend to come give you a foot rub. Oh, man, that felt so good. Recognition. Well, what is that preventing? Other than it feels good. But this is the self-care practice. Just whatever it takes. However, self-care is not egotism, and it's not egoism. Self-care is, Lord, help me know the difference between what's going to feed my flesh and what's going to fill me. I have at least four parts of my being: intellectual, emotional, physical, and spiritual. If I am not tending to Cynthia, the spiritual person, reading the Bible, having time with the Lord, my spirit is going to dry up. If I'm not in good conversations, I feel so sorry for the mommies with 3 and 4 toddlers, and they forget how to talk English, you know. does my hubby want a checky bookie today? No, sweetheart, I want the checkbook, you know, because life is just so different. Okay, the intellectual stimulation, read a book, have a stimulating conversation, engage with other people. That's good for your intellect. Physically, if you're not eating as well balanced as it can be, taking care of, you know, I have a new hip. There's a reason I keep sitting down. It's because I don't do well standing for hours and hours. As I say, my airport days are my crying days, because I just have a little meter inside me that when I run out of so many steps in a day, I'm kind of done and it hurts. But I know that, so I take precautions. I do what I have to do to establish my own boundaries. But in those four areas, but emotionally, we know how to take care of our mind, our body, our spirit. But so many times, and men, may I be just really upfront, bold with you, you're the ones that we hear most often in the counseling room say, I don't know what my emotions are. Never think that way. And that ignorance of the fact that you even have an emotional life, it can really come back at you in a negative way if you're not tending to it. To say, yeah, I'm hurting, and I recognize it, and I need help in that area, or whatever it is. Build in your self-care. Self-care should replenish you, not give you all the little, chocolate-covered strawberry perks kind of thing. That's something else. Okay, the components of resilience. There are 7 components of resilience. Insight, independence, relationship, initiative, creativity, humor, and morality. Why are there 2 people that have been through the very same trauma? One is traumatized and the other one gets through just fine. And they were raised in the same home, in the same family, post 9/11. Why did some people make it through and other people to this day are still struggling? The resilience factors. A lot of these resilience factors will be things that we can actually shore up in our lives. These are times right now that your resilience factors are growing, just sitting in this room, because you are gaining understanding, insight, knowledge, being equipped for what may be ahead. So, with that, how do I know if I'm burning out? I will have emotional exhaustion. You feel overwhelmed by the people you come in contact with. Depersonalization, that's a big one. You begin to reduce your close involvement with other people. When you see yourself isolating, you don't want to be around people. You want to sit in the back corner by yourself. That's depersonalization. And if you have a reduced feeling of effectiveness, you sense that you're becoming a kind of person that other people don't like. I was teaching in a Bible school on toxic people and therapeutic people. It was a counseling course. And I said, there are some people that doesn't matter whether they've gotten the training to be counselors or not, they are therapeutic. They're the kind of person you want to sit down with and you want to pour out your heart because you know they'll just, you know, they'll listen, and therapeutic people. However, there are toxic people that have all the degrees behind their name, and you don't want to, like the guy I mentioned that I go, well, you know, he has the training, and he goes, oh, no, he told me blah, blah, blah. Not going to send them back to that guy. Okay, the toxic person. So I get to the end of the session, and one of the professors that was sitting in the audience came up to me, and he said, I think I'm a toxic person. I go, whoa. Well, that's a big statement. That's a big confession. What do you mean? He said, well, the way you described it, you said people don't come to you. He said, I look at all these students. They go to all the other professors. They want to talk to them after class. My students never want to talk to me. I said, you are at the juncture of a life change, because awareness is step one of a change. You want students to come to you. Okay, let's look at what it is that has you be toxic. What has you distancing yourself from others? How can you appear and be more open? Wow, in a short amount of time. I've gone back to that Bible school various times over the years. He's still a teacher, and he's doing great. He's a liked teacher. He's never going to be the kind of guy who's going to go party with the kids, but my goodness, they respect him. He's got an openness, a new look on life. Just because you recognize something in here that you say, yeah, I've really struggled in that area, it could be that it brought you to this awareness that God will take you to another level. Okay, I think our time is up for now.